where I think the beautiful content comes is in these like really minute personal details about our lives.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear the pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade, but I'm not afraid. The rover crossed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be as rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street.
Welcome to the Drawing Your Own Path podcast. You just heard the voice of the poet Olivia Gatwood, who's our guest today, talking about her ideas about writing and then reciting the lyrics to On the Sunny Side of the Street for us. She's a really good sport. I imposed on her a bit and asked her to read that, and she agreed. So wonderful. Thank you so much, Olivia. In the background, the piano stylings of Doug McKenzie. Look him up on YouTube. He does a tremendous number of piano improvisations, among them On the Sunny Side of the Street, and does a wonderful job. Our guest today, Olivia Gatwood, is a poet, and a performance artist and a teacher. Now, when I started this podcast to address issues of creativity and mindfulness, I mostly got guests that went sort of right down the line, doing a little bit of both. But I always had in mind to just interview artists who are introspective, who look into themselves, who know a lot about the creative process, and Olivia Gatwood is certainly one of those. Her poems are amazing. I've discovered them through YouTube and through Facebook and a group called Button Poetry. They post the videos of her, and we talk about the difference between performing the poems and writing the poems, which I found very interesting. And she's such a performer that she's about to go on tour, and we talk about the tour. It starts on the 23rd of August in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That's 2018, and it goes through 26 cities, ending up in Brooklyn at the Bell House on the 30th of September, 2018, where I hope to be to hear her live. She also has many YouTube videos. One of them's really good. It's a TEDx talk where she talks about the creative process, and that's where I got the idea to have her come here and tell us a little bit about her writing process. So you'll hear some variation in the audio. Olivia was kind enough to do the interview, but she was very busy and was in a car when she did it, so some of the audio is scratchy. I apologize for that. But I've interspersed it with some of the recordings she's made that are out on YouTube of her reading her poems, and they're wonderful, and you'll hear those little poetic interludes. If you like this podcast, Drawing Your Own Path podcast, please give us support. There's lots of ways you can do it. One is that I have a group, a private group on Facebook called Drawing Your Own Path, and please join. Also, the book Drawing Your Own Path, still for sale on Amazon, still needs some reviews. We'd love some great 5-star reviews to help boost our visibility on Amazon. The same for iTunes. If you prefer to go to iTunes, you can give us a 5-star rating there. Again, helps with visibility, gets the word out to more people. And we still have our weekly drawing bee on Tuesday evenings at 9 o'clock. We do this through Zoom, the video chat conferencing software. And we all just sit in our own space and draw together and chat. And it's a little bit of community support for creative practice. If you need a little time during the week to set aside to do a little creative work, that's a good time to do it. Go to iclock.com/draw to find a link to the Zoom room. It's also on Instagram at Drawing Your Own Path. And again, on the Facebook group, I always put links. So it's time to get on with the poetry and the interview. We start off with a poem entitled Ode to My Bitch Face. And if you're easily offended by colorful language or strong ideas, maybe this isn't the podcast for you. But otherwise, you'll see how strong a voice she is and how deeply she looks into her own feelings and ideas and memories as a source for storytelling. In the middle of the podcast, we discuss a poem that's entitled, When I Say That We Are All Teen Girls. It's about teenagerhood, of course, and her own experience, but also how that small experience relates universally, which is a great aspect of her work, that she can bring the small into the universal so easily and from such a personal point of view. And then at the very end of the podcast, she's recorded a poem which is in her new performance and will also be in a new book that she's going to publish this fall. I have her first publication, New American Best Friend. It's a beautiful book of poetry, and she's going to come with a new book this fall, so I'm really looking forward to that. And the poem that she recorded for us today is called Ode to Pink, and that's how we'll end the podcast. So without further ado, please enjoy the poet Olivia Gatwood.
So does everyone know what this term resting bitch face is? Okay, so that's a term coined by someone who is just generally unhappy with the fact that women aren't smiling literally all the time. So you're like sleeping and he's like, you have a bitch face. And you're like, I mean, I'm literally taking a nap. So I'm sorry, I don't know what. So I've been doing this thing lately where I write odes to things I think I'm supposed to feel ashamed of, which is largely how shame works. We think we're supposed to feel it. We're told we're supposed to feel it about the way that we live and act and walk and speak and dress and are. And then we feel it because someone else told us to. It's not an organic feeling, really. So I've been writing odes to things like that to counteract that feeling. So this is an ode to my bitch face. You pink armor, lipstick rebel, steel-cheeked, slit mouth, head to the ground, mean girl. You headphones in but no music. You house key turned blade. You quick step between streetlights, strainer of pricks and chest beaters. Laughter is a foreign language to your dry ice tongue. Resting bitch face, they call you. But there is nothing restful about you. No, lips like a flatlined heartbeat panic at the sight of you, scream for their mothers, throat full of bees, head spun 360, exorcist bitch. Just trying to buy a soda, just trying to do your laundry, just trying to dance at the party, and then someone asks you to smile, and the blood begins to riot. Smile, and you chisel away at your own jaw. Smile, and you unleash the swarm into the mouth of a man who wants to swallow you whole. One theory is that you were born like this, but I don't believe it. You came out screaming and alive, and look at you now. Look at how you've learned to hide your teeth. What's wrong with your face, bitch? Your face, bitch, what's wrong with it? Bitch face, I don't blame you for taking the iron pipe from their hands and branding yourself with it, for making a flag out of your body bag. Another theory is that you put it on every morning. Screw it tight like a jar of jelly, but I don't believe that either. You woke up like this and have been for years. How can you sleep pretty when there are four locks on the door and the fire escape feels like break-in bait? They will tell you home is safe zone. No, bitch face is safe zone. Bitch face is home. Bitch face is cutting off the ladder, willing to burn in the apartment if it means he can't get in.
Welcome to the Drawing Your Own Path podcast, and today we have Olivia Gatwood, a wonderful poet who I've followed on YouTube and who's about to make a big tour. So welcome, Olivia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I just thought we'd start off talking about the tour because I think it's maybe it's unusual that a group of poets tour, or maybe it's I just don't know, but you're going to go with a group all the way around America.
Yeah, so I think it's unusual to a lot of people. I think sometimes I have a warped perspective about what's normal because I have existed in a poetry community for the last 10 years, and most of my friends are full-time writers and poets. So to me, you know, it's like everybody in my life tours and goes around the country reading poetry. So to me, it's like a very normal, obvious job, but I'm always confronted with the fact that it's not when I tell people on airplanes or airports or wherever I am that I am a full-time poet. But this tour is a little different. I've spent the last four years touring colleges and universities doing poetry, and was more so doing it with an educational lens. So I was kind of functioning as almost a lecturer at colleges, which is a familiar profession. A lot of different sort of lecturers and motivational speakers tour around colleges, and that's what I was doing, but with poetry. And I was mostly educating about consent and Title IX and healthy relationships. And so that was what I was doing for a long time. So touring is pretty familiar to me, but I have recently sort of transferred over from colleges into music venues, because after several years of touring colleges, I realized that I was not only alone, I was touring alone, so I didn't have a team at all. But also I was kind of losing my identity as an artist, because I was functioning more so as a teacher. And while being a teacher is great, I also was really curious about expanding myself as a performance artist, and being given an opportunity to really connect with people who wanted to be there, not students who had to be there as a class requirement, but people who bought tickets and came and were excited to listen to poetry. And also to be able to collaborate with musicians, to be in a space that's meant for performance. So I made it a kind of goal to do that. So that's how this tour is different from other tours. And we have an opening act named Joaquina Mertz, who's a musician. And then we're picking up different poets along the way in different cities. So, yeah, it should be a really cool, fun show. And that aspect of it is fairly new. I don't want to say new, but less common, I guess. Are poets occupying what is usually a space for music?
It just sounds really terrific. I can't wait. I know there's a show in Brooklyn toward the end of the tour. That's the one I'm hoping to go to, because I live right near New York. But you go to Oregon, you go into the South. I know you do a show in Arkansas. You go everywhere. So I'm encouraging people to go to OliviaGatwood.com and see the whole schedule, or get on her mailing list for sure.
Yeah, we'll be in 26 cities.
Wow.
And we're going coast to coast. We have one show in Toronto, so we're going to be everywhere.
So in this venue, it sounds like there's some improvisation and some newness in each city. You say you're picking up poets along the way. How much is already, do you know already what you're going to read, and how much are you going to remix as you go?
So every show is going to be a little bit different in terms of lineup. Like I said, we'll be picking up different poets along the way. I'm working on my set list right now, so I'm going to try to do a mix of things people have seen on the internet and are excited to see in person. And I also do new work. I have a lot of new work. I am coming out with a new book next fall, so I'm going to try to implement more of that. And I try to make every show that I do cohesive, and instead of just a bunch of poems, I try to make sure that my poems are in conversation with each other, and that they create like a realistic or rather, cohesive arc. So I'm working on that right now.
Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah, and I'm really excited to hear you have a new book coming. That's news to me.
Yeah.
I have a copy of New American Best Friend. I guess that's your first book. It's a wonderful book. It's beautifully printed. The cover's beautiful. The whole
thing
is not so nice. And really, it's the first poetry book in a long time I read cover to cover right away. I was really absorbed in it.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
So I'm very excited.
Thank you so much.
I'm excited to hear you have new material, and I love what you do. I can't really watch the poems on YouTube without tearing up. That's how effective they are. So I think they really touch something really deep. And I want to go a little bit into how you create that and where you're coming from. I think that's what we'll be most interested in. When I read them and I see the interplay of the words and the language and how they fit together, and then I hear them, it's really different. What do you think about that difference between when you're there in front of people performing it and when you ask people to read it, when you publish it in a book?
So I got my start in spoken words. So there was a long period of time where I was writing with the understanding that nobody was going to see the print of the poem, that I was in full control of how people received it. And that was, it's basically scary for obvious reasons, in the way that getting on stage and telling people about your life is scary, but I got used to it pretty quickly. And that means that the prospect of people holding my work in their hands and getting to sit with it was really scary, and was a really foreign concept to me. So when I started working on New American Best Friend, I had never thought of myself as a writer, really. I more so thought of myself as a performer. So it was nerve-wracking, you know, to not only realize that people could interpret your poems however they wanted to. You actually have very little control as a writer, but also that they could sit with it for as long as they wanted to. It wasn't a thing where you got to go off stage and then it was over. And that I had to consider how the poem looked physically, the form that it was taking. So it just felt like there was a lot more to think about. And it's nerve-wracking, too, to put your work into the world because with a book, because you don't know whose hands it's going to end up in, right? And so there was a long time that as a performer, I really felt safe in that. And writing a book was a new kind of fear. So, ultimately I've grown to really, I'm more religious to it than I am to performing at this point, or for it to exist only within performance. I like when both exist at the same time. Sometimes at my shows, people will bring their copy of their book and read along. And I really love that, because I think that's such a mutual experience. They're experiencing it for themselves while I'm giving it to them. So I've thought of writing as a really giving act. It's less so, performing for me used to be very like an emotional release, and writing at this point has become very much a conversation between myself and my reader. So I have a lot of poems now. I was not able to say this for a long time, but I have a lot of poems now that I'll probably never perform, only because I think they are meant to exist on the page. And that doesn't mean that they can't be read aloud, but that I personally don't feel a need to perform them. And I want my readers to just have it in that way.
Wonderful. That's such great insight. It's kind of the reverse of the way I thought about it, the writing first, but you did the performing first. So I find that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And the transition there.
Yeah.
And with the image you made, you said you're more religious to the writing, and then mentioned that people brought their books. I just had this image of like a prayer service, you know, and they're reading from the book.
Exactly. Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah.
It's a really beautiful image. Let's talk about, you say you got into the performance first. Where did the urge begin for you? At what age, and how did it feel, and how did you find that standing up in front of people saying that was the way to let it out?
I was an athlete for a lot of my life, from a really young age throughout high school, and that was sort of my identity. But I quickly started to feel like there was an artistic side of myself that I wasn't using. And so I've always loved poetry my whole life, from the time I was very young, and I've always loved to read poetry aloud. When I was even, you know, in elementary school, and I had a Shel Silverstein book, and I would read it aloud to myself because I liked hearing it out loud. I liked hearing the rhythm, and I liked playing with enunciation. I've always liked to read aloud to other people and to myself. And so I think that part of me was really natural. I just didn't know that there was a place for it. I actually wasn't a performative kid. I was pretty introverted, definitely social, but not the kind of, you know, you hear about these kids that, or you hear about like pop stars when they were kids. They're like, oh, I was always putting on shows and I was always trying to be on a stage. Like, I was not that kid. The thought of getting on stage was just like, there was no way. But I did feel this like incredible connection to spoken word. I felt, while my friends would maybe be sitting there kind of bored and like, this is weird, who are all these people like yelling at me, I felt like they were magicians, you know. I felt like this was, I just could have watched it for hours and hours and hours. Like, I was just in awe. And this was before there was a YouTube poetry world. And so I didn't have access to watching spoken word unless it was in person.
Did you feel some truths were being revealed, some unseen world was coming out in through those performances?
Yeah, I think that there was, I think it was a combination of, I've always loved storytelling and I love listening to stories. Like, I'm a big fan of really good podcasts for that reason. I just love listening to stories. And so I think spoken word poetry is storytelling. And so I liked hearing other people's stories. I liked knowing that a lot of things I was feeling as a teenage girl weren't crazy, and I wasn't alone in those feelings. It was really a validating experience. I have always loved hip hop. And so, like, at times someone would get on the open mic and, you know, and would beatbox or would rap. And I really loved that. And so it just was like this amalgamation of, like, both the aesthetics of poetry, the sound, the rhythm, but also, like, the emotional aspect of feeling seen and validated. And also, the sympathy in me was being triggered, you know? I was able to listen to other people's experiences about the world. And it was put in such a concise and beautiful way. And then I learned about slam poetry. And coming from a sports background, the prospect of competition and strategy was not only really familiar to me, but it was also something that I really liked. I really thrived off of that. And so I wrote my own poetry. I would write it in journals and would read it aloud to my soccer team, because not because I wanted necessarily to perform, but more so because I really felt like I needed people to know how I meant this poem. Like, I needed them to hear it from me. I didn't want them to read it out of my journal. I needed to have control over how it was received. So I would perform for my soccer team without knowing really what I was doing. I just was like, I have a poem and I want to read it to you, but I need you to hear it from me. So, you know, people knew this about me. And then one day, my sophomore year in high school, my friend in chemistry class was sitting next to me, and he was a rapper. So he was really into, like, ciphers and freestyling. And so he was going to poetry club, and he was like, you should come to poetry club with me. I think you'd like it. And I was like, all right. So I went with him. And it was just a bunch of kids my age who had the same interest that I did. And before that, I had really only thought the only place that existed was in soccer. Like, that was where I found my people. And suddenly there was, like, this new corner of people that I had been going to school with that I didn't know, who, like, also felt the magic of poetry. And so I just kept going. And then every year the poetry club would do a showcase for the whole school. We had a really wonderful poetry teacher who really, like, championed for the poetry students and who really believed in its presence in school. And so she would put on this, like, school assembly almost, where the poets would perform. And it was my turn, and I wrote a poem, and I got on stage, and I was horrifically nervous. I was really quiet, and I read my poem. And luckily, the assembly took place over several periods. So, like, the first chunk of students would come in for first period, and then the next chunk of students. So you had a chance, you'd get the whole day off school, and you'd have a chance to read your poem, like, 7 times, basically. So, you know, I went up to my friend afterwards, and I was like, did I do good? And she was like, yeah, you did good, but you were quiet. So I was like, all right, cool. So next period, I'm not going to be quiet. And then the next period, I tried to be louder, and I was like, oh, yeah, you were good, but you need to, like, lift your head up, or you should do something with your hands. And so every period, like, in this one day, I was able to, like, really start to think of this as not just an emotional outlet, but as a sport, almost, like, as something I needed to perfect. And I really thrive off of that. Yeah. And so after that, I was just hooked, and I just was like, okay, there's a right way to do this. And, you know, I don't mean that to say that some people are doing it the wrong way, but I mean that it is something to be practiced. Yeah, it is something that to be mastered, you
path
know?
For improvement, for sure.
Exactly.
It's
and
amazing.
It's bigger than just letting out. Sorry, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, no, your descriptions are so great, of course. To think of you as an athlete, well, I see you in the YouTube videos, you know, and you seem unassuming and sort of slight and, you know, maybe a little quiet.
Yeah.
You know, to think of you as this fierce soccer player, such a great image. And then there you are giving, like, the coach's locker room fiery talk, but it's your poems you're reading. It's another beautiful image that it wants to find its, you know, the energy wants to find its way out. Your voice wants to find its way. So it came out in the soccer locker room, and then it found its way on the stage. And there you were, like, doing a 7 stage tour. At each one improving. I think that's also such a great image. What kind of poems were you writing in those days?
So I was writing, well, it started off out with, actually when I was 10 years old, we had a poetry segment in my class and we had to write a poem, and I, you know, turned to my Shel Silverstein book and I was like, okay, I'm going to write, this is what I know what a poem is. So I'm going to write one in the same kind of rhyme scheme. It's like, like very kind of sing song. And so I wrote one about my brother, and it was kind of like a diss poem. Like I wrote all about like how much my brother annoys me. And then I performed it for my family, and my brother got really upset, but I liked that. I liked that I had like, you know, like pulled a reaction out of somebody.
Right.
And then, you know, when I was in middle school, I was writing poems about love and jealousy and friendship and all the things that a 13-year-old girl is trying to process. But the poem that I ultimately read aloud to my high school was about being harassed on the street by men. and I was, you know, 16, and I didn't identify as a feminist, and I didn't know anything about feminism or about empowerment, really. I just knew that this thing didn't make me feel good.
Right.
And I thought that I could warrant pull a reaction out of people in the same way. And so,
it's beautiful.
About that.
Yeah, it's all right there. It's so beautiful.
Not much has changed in my content.
Kind of amazing, really. You know, sometimes you see work, like there's a Edward Hopper house is near here, and you see a drawing that he made at like 9, and it has all the technical points and skills of his later paintings. So it's like, you had an instinct to talk about the emotional moments in your life and the unfolding that happens from that. You know, maybe it was a lucky chance, maybe it was good instinct that there it was, that's the power of the work that you do, is that you take something that's really very common and very much experienced by you and unfold it into something that we all share.
Absolutely.
There's a poetry group around here. There's actually a couple of places to hear poetry, and one is a weekly poetry workshop called Milkweed Poetry Workshop, and I bring my daughter there sometimes, and we like to write poems. When she writes, like you're saying, like about love and about death and about kind of these big things that a young girl will write about, and I tell her, you write poems like a teenage girl. but for her, you see, it's a compliment because she's only 10.
So I was like, oh, wow, that's so funny.
She's not a teenager yet, but you even have a poem about, like, we're all teenage girls.
Yeah,
This is for my best friend, Melissa Lozada Oliva. When I say that we are all teen girls, what I mean is that when my grandmother called to ask why I didn't respond to her letter, all I heard was, why didn't you text me back? Why don't you love me? And how can I talk about my grandmother without also mentioning that if everyone is a teen girl, then so are the birds, their soaring clicks, their squawking throats, and the sea, of course the sea. It's moody push and pull, the way we drill into it, fill it with our trash, take and take and take from it, and still it holds us each time we walk into it. What is more teen girl than not being loved, but wanting it so badly that you accept the smallest crumb and call yourself full? What is more teen girl than my father's favorite wrench, than the whine of the floorboards in my mother's house? What is more teen girl than my dog, Jack, whose bark is shrill and unnecessary, who has never once stopped a burglar or healed on command, but sometimes when I laugh, his tail wags so hard it thumps against the wall. Sometimes it sounds like a heartbeat. Sometimes I yell at him for talking too much, for his messy room. Sometimes I put him in pink striped polos and I think he feels pretty. I think he likes to feel pretty. I think Jack is a teen girl, and the mountains, oh, the mountains, what teen girls they are, those colossal show-offs and the moon glittering and distant and dictating all of our emotions. My lover is tender but heavy breath while she sleeps is a teen girl. How it holds me and keeps me awake all at once. How sometimes I wish to silence it until she turns her body and the room goes quiet and suddenly I want it back. Imagine the teen girls gone from our world and how quickly we would beg for their return. How grateful would we be then for their loud enthusiasm and ability to make a crop top out of anything? Even the men who laugh their condescending laughs when a teen girl faints at the sight of her favorite pop star, even those men are teen girls, the way they want so badly to be big and important and worshipped by someone. Donald Trump, teen girls and his tiny tweeting hands. Pluto, teen girls and her rejection from the popular universe. And my father, a teen girl who insists he doesn't believe in horoscopes but wants me to tell him the best traits of a Scorpio. I tell him we are all just teen girls, and my father, having raised me, recounts the time he found the box of love notes and condom wrappers I hid in my closet, the missing socks, the radio blaring over my pitchy sobs, the time I was certain I would die of heartbreak, and in a moment was in love with a small new boy. And of course, the teen girls, the real teen girls, huddled on the subway after school, limbs draped over each other's shoulders, bones knocking, an awkward wind chime, and all of the commuters who plug in their headphones to mute the giggle, silence the gaggle and squeak, not knowing where they learned to do this, to roll their eyes and turn up the music, not knowing where they learned this palpable rage, not knowing the teen girls who are our most distinguished professors, who teach us to bury the burst until we close our bedroom doors and then cry with blood in the neck, foot through the door, face in the pillow, the teen girls who teach us to scream.
Are who we are, I think, pretty like to our core at a young age, and then we lose ourselves for a little bit, and then we like come back to that former self after the world has had its way with us. And I think about that a lot, and I think about how like I think that at my core, when I was 13 years old, I think there were so many parts of myself that I really wished were different, were quieter or smaller or less obvious or altogether just like different. And I think I spent a lot of time trying to suppress those things, trying to suppress my emotions and be less dramatic or be more chill or whatever. And after years of that, you know, coming into myself as a woman and realizing like, oh no, this is part of who I am. I am an emotional person. And these specific things do affect me. And this is how I love people. Or this is like, these are the things that piss me off. And they always have been. And so I think like I really identify with my teenage self in that way. And I think sometimes about my teenage self as like this other person that still lives inside of me that I have so much empathy and love for. And when I was a teenager, I didn't have empathy and love for her. I really didn't want to be her. And now I feel so tender towards her. And so I started to think about that and think about the way that the world, I think, altogether really trivializes teenage girls. And even the things teenage girls love are written off as not being quality. Like any music teenage girls love is immediately written off as not good music. And I think we just generally talk about the things teen girls love as things that are somehow different from us, or that we're above, or we're better than. And so I wrote that poem as a way of expressing that own feeling about myself. But then I started to really open my eyes and think about the qualities that are attributed to teenage girls, and how all of those qualities exist in the world, you know, exist in everybody, exist in my father, you know? And so, yeah, I it was really fun to write that poem actually, because it was just like thinking of the most ludicrous and exaggerated examples.
All those sort of qualities that are exaggerated perhaps in a teenage girl, but can be found in everyone, in everyone's behavior. And I really love that about your writing, is that kind of distillation takes place of the specific into the general, or the general into the specific. I don't know how you see it one way or the other, but by looking closely at an individual quality, seeing the universal in it, and using the teenage girl, which was your direct experience that couldn't be denied, as the basis for that description, just gives it so much strength.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that poem.
I want to go a little more into that about the writing, because you make a talk on the TEDx. I think it was in Albuquerque.
Yeah,
and,
it was.
And you and I imagine this is how you sort of conduct your workshops, although it's quicker and more general in the talk. But you describe the writing process, how you take people through the writing process. Can you give us just a quick little summary of that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of when I teach classes, a lot of the students are there because they're interested in spoken word specifically, or they're interested in slam poetry specifically, and I empathize with that because that's who I was and am. And but with the idea of performing for an audience comes, I think, a pressure to write a poem that encapsulates everything, or write a poem, the poem that will fix it, or the poem that will change the world, or the poem that, you know, like just like says everything. And the reality is you have in slam poetry, you have 3 minutes to say what you need to say. Obviously poetry that isn't existing in that competition can be however long you want it. But you know, most people, I think, generally write about 3 minutes or less. So, you don't have time to say everything, and you don't have time to like fix the world, and you're not going to. And so I think that the best way to conquer topics that feel insurmountable, like huge, you know, systematic issues like misogyny or racism or homophobia, right? Like these are huge and layered and intersecting systems. And so the way I think to approach it is not to say, I'm going to write a poem about misogyny, but to think of the really small moments in your life that exemplify that, things that you have survived, that you went through, and start there. And so you don't have to name it as a poem about misogyny, because it just will be that. Mm. So, like, a lot of people say that the specific is universal, and I find that that's another way to get people that I think helps people empathize. I think we often look at our own experiences and this is something I hear a lot, is young people being like, oh, but nobody will care or nobody will get it. And I actually think that like the more specific you get, the more relatable your poem is. So even if someone, you know, if you are writing a poem about visiting your aunt's house in the summer, like even if someone has never been to that aunt's house or doesn't have an aunt, right? Or like, you know, has never been to that part of the country or whatever. If you can describe the smell when you walk into the house, what the carpet looks like the sound of your aunt's laugh, people are going to immediately have empathy and understand what you're talking about, and will pull naturally from their own lives and say, oh, this is kind of like this thing that I experienced, and see themselves in it. So, you know, that was something that I learned over time from a multitude of authors, and then sort of put into words for myself. And I try to always encourage people to start from a smaller place versus walking into it and being like, okay, how do I write this PSA, you know?
Yeah, and you give the example, start with the whole backyard and then talk about the swimming pool and then talk about maybe your bathing suit.
Right.
And so you get people in a way, when you ask people to come up with a memory just randomly, really often a strong emotion just naturally comes up. So they're already starting with a sort of a big bubble of emotion, and then allowing themselves to pick out, you know, more and more specific details, I think is a great way to guide someone into, and an easy way to allow them to get to a strong emotional content.
Yeah, because I think that like the most common thing you hear when you're teaching poetry to young people especially is like, well, I don't know what to write about, you know, well, I don't know what to say. And so I think like it's the only thing we have in our lives that are just ours really is our memories. And like whether or not those memories are reliable is not irrelevant, but isn't, I don't think, as important right now. Like all we have is what we've experienced. And I think that people like generally, whether or not, like I'm a storyteller, so I'm obsessed with my own memories and I hold them really closely. But I think even if you're not, like we walk through the world with like understanding how to function based on what we remember. Like we're like, okay, I know not to do this because I remember learning this, or I remember experiencing this, or I remember hearing this. And so like if you know, you can say that you don't know what to write about, but if someone says, you know, write down one memory you have in a backyard. Like, everybody has that memory,
True.
You know? And usually that's where I think the beautiful content comes, is in these, like, really minute personal details about our lives.
Do you feel like the minute details that people get to present themselves because of their strong emotional content?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, because every memory is tied to something bigger. So, like, I think that we do, like, we remember things because they have an emotional tie to us and things stick with us. My dad always says, like, when I don't remember what I was about to say, like, if I'm going to say something and then I forget and I'm like, oh, I can't remember. He always says, well, it must not have been that important. And while I don't always believe that, I think sometimes, like, the things that we remember, we don't always know why they're important, but I think that they are.
Yeah, I love that. A lot of the people in the Drawing Your Own Path group and that listen to this are meditators. And it's part of being in concentration meditation is slowing all that down. And maybe you're just going to listen to your breath, the feeling of your breath in your nostrils like this. And so it's almost like you want to reduce the whole feel to just one little thing. And all of a sudden the whole world is there, you know? And the same is true. Same is true in drawing. When you're going to draw a picture of something very complicated, and you think you can't do it, you start to get into the pattern of a small detail. All of a sudden, the whole thing opens up. You know, you see the whole world in that small detail.
Yeah, I love that analogy.
It just seems to work so well in the poetry and the way you make it work. I think the way you're just open enough to share those memories and also to really be open to the larger issues. I mean, I think it's so timely that the work you're doing now, it's like if you had to be in a right place, right time for the subject matter and the whole thing of what's going on in the world, I think it just suits really well. It's so it resonates on so many levels. It resonates as good poetry, and it resonates as very great personal statement, but it also resonates in sort of the larger political climate, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, like, the political climate right now is horrific. But I also, and so I do think my work is important in that. I'm grateful that I'm writing right now. I'm grateful that, like, I am a voice right now, and I'm grateful for so many of the voices that exist right now. And I also, you know, I don't intend on stopping, regardless of what changes. As much as I would like there to be a world that was so good, I never had to write about anything at all except for nature and my own joy. I don't imagine that will happen.
I also mean political, like feminism is political and racism is political.
Yeah,
And of course, there's been feminism as a issue for a long time. But I do think in the last few years, just because of that climate, it's really reached some crescendos. There have been some really incredible moments amongst the chaos. And I think your voice is a strong voice in that. I think people can start to nod and support all that in a really strong way.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I think that, like, a lot of people are really anti-social media. But I personally think that, like, art, and that social media is actually really good for artists, because I think that, like, we now have an ability, I think that information is much more accessible now.
Yes.
And obviously there can be a downside to that. But I think that, like, before there was this, like, open forum, almost like Twitter is like where I get my news, because I feel like it's like news from the people, which is more reliable. And so before, you know, even within feminism, there were only a select number of voices that were speaking for a whole population. And that's not reliable. You
know? Yes.
Not, like, can't possibly be accurate. And we're not doing the work properly if that's how it is.
What you're saying is true, because if a few people dominate the discussion, then it's much easier to oppose the viewpoints of just those few people without showing the complexity of the whole issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, like, art is in many ways and historically has been the way that we learn about the emotional side of politics, of identity, and of relationships. And so, like, you know, I think that, like, I'm one of the people who grew up in English classes, like wanting to like the books we were reading, but really not seeing myself in them. And so I think that, like, now with the internet, I see that when I go to high schools, I see young people, they're able to find art that they identify with and that they understand and that they feel an emotional connection to. And so I think that, like, when you think of art in that way as political, we're at a really important time right now just because we can get our hands on so much more.
Yeah, and there's so many avenues for the multitude of voices can be heard, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you're a meditator or if you're in where you sit, but what's your relationship to, you know, mindfulness, spirituality, and that sort of thing?
I grew up in a pretty godless household, is what I like to call it. My dad is like a pretty hardcore atheist, and he like lives that to the core. I mean, he's not spiritual. He's not religious, but he's also not spiritual. And so I grew up not really like having access to that language or understanding. But I have learned about it over the years. I think that I've meditated a few times. I by no means is it a part of my regular life. But I have learned about mindfulness, and it's something that I work on and something that I like have sought to
right.
incorporate into my life
because
I definitely need it. Yeah.
So when you write, though, when you write, it seems to me you're in really deep introspection.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't know who said it. I feel like it was like a dead white guy poet said sometime that the best writing doesn't come from you, it comes through you. And I think that that's true. Like when I'm really in the wave of writing, it's traveling through me, and those are moments where I'm not only like deeply focused and introspective, but I'm also, I think, in a state of bliss, even if what I'm writing is difficult.
Yes. Yeah, that's beautifully said. Yeah, a lot of what we talk about in this group is how creative practice is a kind of contemplative practice. Creative practice is a method for getting to those states that you just described. And I think you feel that even if you didn't know you were meditating, you might have been deep in meditation when you're doing your creative work.
Cool. Yeah. So, well, then in that case, I do meditate.
Yeah, I would say so. What you just described sounded just like where you want to be. So, but also I wanted to ask you, because you do work with difficult material and difficult personal material, do you feel that writing the poems and getting it out and performing them, is that a healing thing for you?
Yeah, I think in a way it is. I have a complicated relationship with that. I think that, you know, poetry is my job. So it wasn't always. And I think that there was a time when writing and performing was like a deeply cathartic process, and that healing, yes, and also I think more so, and maybe this is synonymous with healing, but figuring things out. So like approaching a topic that I felt either made me upset, but I didn't quite know why, and being able to name it. Like my biggest frustration in everything is feeling misunderstood. Like if I feel someone doesn't understand where I'm coming from, I like want to rephrase and rephrase and rephrase and rephrase until I feel like I can get it out perfectly. Mm. And that's not necessarily a quality. There are many times that has been not a quality, but not a good quality. So I feel like I do write from a place of really, really deeply wanting to be understood. But also, like I said, writing and poetry is my job. And so sometimes I approach it as work, you know, like sometimes, especially on tour, if you're getting on stage every single night for a month and you're doing that 30 times, not every night that you're doing the same poem is that going to be a healing experience.
Right.
Sometimes it's exhausting.
Right.
Sometimes you're like, I don't feel like being angry, so I need to perform anger. I don't feel like being sad, so I need to perform that. Or like, you know, and sometimes it's like, I'm not going to do that poem at all. Sometimes you learn to disassociate from your poems and just sort of do them like on autopilot in the way that a waitress does her job. You
right.
know, like you just sort of, and so there are times when I feel really healed by my own poetry. There are times when especially in the writing phase, when I feel like, oh, okay, like, I get it now. You know, with this new book I'm working on, like, I approach this book with a lot of questions, and I do feel like I understand myself and the things I'm writing about much better. But it's not always healing. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's just nothing at all. You know,
I, you know, in my visual work, I make work and I feel like there's a lot of catharsis in the making of the work, and I get a lot out. And then when the work's out and people are looking at it, I can see other people going through their own experience, but I'm not anymore feeling it. You know, it's kind of been done, and that may be something similar. But when you're performing it, you're really performing a service to others to bring them through that somehow.
Right. Sometimes you're healing other people.
Yeah.
And you're not healing yourself, you know, and those things can happen at the same time. Sometimes they happen at different times. But, you know, I think that, like, there are many moments on the road, especially, where I feel like I'm doing an act of service to other people.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's true. It's a gift in a lot of ways, I think, that you go out and read because of how powerful it is. I want to go back to what you were talking about, sometimes it feels like it's coming through you. It's not you, but it's kind of coming through you. So I want to point back to that for a second and just kind of get your thoughts about what do you think that is that's coming through?
You know, it's such an intangible feeling, and it's almost like something that I don't want to exclude anyone, but sometimes I'm like, only people who've experienced it know what it is. You know, like, there's no way to say, but I think what it is for me, is like, I think it's as simple as saying that I have found the right words, you know?
Beautiful.
I think that, like, when we're fraught, when we're blocked, when we don't know how to, like, what to write, it's because we don't have the right words for it. Of course, we're always capable of writing something down. Writer's block isn't the inability to write something down. We can always write something down. But I think writer's block is, like, not being able to write the right thing down. And when it's coming through you, I think you're just, like, your body and your mind is giving you exactly what you need. And maybe that can be, like, maybe a way to describe it to someone who hasn't experienced it or isn't a writer. I think everybody knows what it feels like to get in the rhythm of something, whether that's running, and you're 3 miles in and you're like, oh damn, like, I'm not actually that tired. I could go for a few more miles. Like, I found my pace. This is a perfect song. Like, it's nice outside. Like, I'm in the zone. When I was a waitress, there was the moment that you, like, really get it down and you're not forgetting anyone's orders and you're just like, everything's on time. Or like cleaning. A lot of people talk about cleaning that way. Like, it's really hard to start cleaning, but you know, when you just, like, get in the zone and then suddenly you're, like, organizing the very back of your closet and you're like, oh damn, I'm, like, in the zone right now. I guess that's what I feel like when I'm writing, and it's going well.
We don't need it. We don't need to evoke any energy or outside entity. It's just being, like, sort of perfectly in rhythm in the moment, perfectly in tune with the moment.
Yeah, and I think that there are things that can jumpstart that. Like, I'm a big fan of reading while I write, because sometimes, like, another person's word will evoke, you know, the rhythm.
Right.
Like, I'll see a possibility, and I'll be like, oh wow, like, that's how you can open a poem, or that, like, just some. For me, often it's like literally a singular word. Like, I'll see the right word to describe something, and it doesn't even mean that I'll use that word. It just, like, it evokes, like, a sensual emotion, and so I find it.
How do you feel that? When you get sparked like that, does it present itself as a feeling in the body? Do you feel it physically?
I wouldn't say as much physically as I would, like, emotionally, like, more so, like, it's almost like a light bulb.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah, like, okay, that's right. Like, that, when you hear I think poetry is like the desire to describe things, not just perfectly, but, like, go one step beyond that, and describe it emotionally. And so I think, like, when I see something an intangible thing described as tangible, I feel, like, sparked.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that it's not like chills run up my spine. It's not, like, physical necessarily, but something in my brain clicks, and I'm like, okay, now I know how to take one step forward.
Yeah, that's a great description. And I think it's fine to say that you don't know it till you experience it, because you could say the same about, say, chocolate ice cream, you know? And yet all you have to do is put it in your mouth and taste it to know, right? So all you have to do is start writing to figure it out. But you have to actually do it to know it. I think that's true.
Yeah.
There's a couple more things. I don't want to keep you any longer than I said. People are listening and they want to kind of get started. And of course, they can listen to your TEDx talk. But if there's any little tip or anything to kind of, they get excited now hearing you and they want to write a poem, like step one.
Yeah, I think the advice I always give, and I think a lot of writers give, is to read and read and read and consume and consume and consume. I think that sometimes it's easy to have favorites, and it's also easy to like write off a whole genre altogether. But, you know, I think the reality is, like, if you like me, there's a million other people you'll like. It's kind of like that section on Amazon where they're like, if you like this, or like customers who bought this also bought this, you know, like that. Yeah. I think is true for writing. And so I think just go down the rabbit hole and keep clicking and keep figuring out what you like and what you don't like, because the sooner you figure that out, the sooner you'll be able to create work that you like, create the work that you want to see in the world. And so I think the first step is to read a lot and to watch a lot. I think watching videos is just as much as a viable form of consummation.
So you want to find that resonance, that thing that you really love, and try to use that energy to put into your work.
Exactly. And to really figure out why you love it, you know, like, what is it? Do you love the language that's being used? Do you love how the writer is the writer brief, or are they writing really long poems? Like, what about the work do you love? And try to replicate it, you know, try to like do it yourself, just like test it out and see what your voice sounds like in that way. And I think gradually a person's voice will come together.
Terrific. So terrific. Well, I'm wishing you the best and all the success on this upcoming tour. I'm sure you're going to be really, really well received. I'm going to do my best to get this out in the next week or two so that it'll be out there before the tour starts. And just want to really, really thank you a lot for the conversation. It was terrific. I learned a lot. I really had some great insights into you and it would just make me enjoy your work a lot more. So thank you for your time. I absolutely appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Ode to Pink. My favorite color is Pepto-Bismol. My favorite color is amoxicillin. My favorite color is the calamine bottle. I want to be sick just to swallow you. Offer up my most blood-filled parts and rub pink on the itchy pink bites. Everyone keeps telling me about their muses, and I want one too, but I don't believe in people, so I nominate you. Always using your best baby voice to get the discount, but slurring your words the whole time. Something I learned in middle school, after Elise smashed Casey Vivian's head into the sidewalk twice, so she got two bumps like horns and everyone called her the devil, is that you never know someone is a fake bitch. You can just feel it, and that's reason enough to hate them. But I like you for it. I liked Casey Vivian too, to be honest. I like the way you bait and switch, Ponzi scheme doing a pirouette, boiler room boutique tool, if rubbed hard enough against the skin, starts to feel like sandpaper, the way all of our wounds begin with you. I'm not looking for empowerment. I don't care about femininity or whatever. I just like the things they call you when you change. Coral, bubblegum, millennial, hot. I like the way everyone has an opinion and all you have is a comeback. How you show up to the party with a new hair cut and everyone convinces themselves they've never met you, offers to pour you a drink, wants to try on your fabulous coat. I fall for the marketing. I bought the mace for girls,
the toolbox. If I could make it so, I would make it so. My whole house coated in a layer of you. If my roommate wasn't a goth, we'd have a couch the color of flamingo. Fridge like a dipped and dyed Easter egg. Inside, only rosé and sliced grapefruit. Himalayan salt in the cabinet. Beet juice smeared across the counter. My dainty assassin. High stakes, rare steak. Wisest rookie on the team. If the thing I hate is the color of you, I love it. There's a pink switchblade on my counter. If a man holds it to my throat one day, I'll make an exception for you. I'll smile and say, do it.